Today I would like to begin by finishing up the material from yesterday. This is for today, so don't worry about it yet. A look at Mariology in the Middle Ages. It was the last point in the outline from yesterday. I have four items here in the development of Mariology. The material comes primarily from Meege's book, M-I-E-G-G-E, On the Virgin Mary, and then from an article in Theology Today from 1956 on Marian theology. If you are interested in reading these for further detail and for the footnotes, I think you will find that quite helpful. The four points that I would like to make is that in the early church, or around the year 200, as you recall from your reading in Irenaeus specifically, as well, this also occurs in Tertullian and Hippolytus and elsewhere, Mary is referred to primarily as the advocate of Eve. The early church usually discusses Mary in connection with Christ. In other words, the interest in Mary is never on Mary qua Mary, but always on Mary as she is associated with the work of Christ. The book of the birth of Mary and the book of James and things of that sort all indicate this same thing. Then around 400, in connection with the emphasis on virginity, on this kind of asceticism that we looked at in connection with the writings of St. Jerome, you have a greater and greater emphasis on the perpetual virginity of the Virgin Mary. They will be debating the question of perpetual virginity and the Theotokos, that, as you recall, was debated so haughtily in between 431 and 451, all through the Middle Ages. They'll still be talking about the nature of the virginity of Mary. And the fact that she was always a virgin in the 9th century, for example. Rodbertus and Rodtromnus also debated this question, whether Mary was a virgin before her womb was parted, still a virgin when her womb was parted, or even a virgin after her womb was parted. And they came up, of course, with the suggestion that she's always a virgin. Jesus was born of Mary, but he was not, he did not, well, the word they use is erumpti, part her womb, I suppose you would say, so that she always remains a virgin. Jesus is not born as other men are born, because such erumpti would be a result of sin. Mary had no sin, therefore there could be no erumpti. This is all part of the discussion of her always being a virgin, even though she bore Christ, not only before the birth or during the birth, but also after the birth. She remains a virgin. As I say, this is discussed, at least you begin to find discussions of this, in the last part of the 4th century, and then from then on. Then by 600, you have the honor of Mary, emphasis on the stages of Mary's life parallel to the stages of the life of our Lord. So that you talk about the nativity of Mary, the presentation of Mary, the purification of Mary, the annunciation of Mary, just as you talk about these things in connection with Christ. So greater and greater emphasis, as I indicated, on Mary, apart from Christ. A series of cultic observances that are not necessarily related, except as parallel to the feast part of the church year in connection with Christ. Then, around 1200, you have the next step, as far as we are concerned in this course, when you begin to discuss questions of in connection with the Immaculate Conception. I shouldn't say begin to discuss it, but this you have a great number of works in the 12th and 13th centuries on this question. Here again, I think St. Anselm is very important in England. The kind of things that he says about Mary, he has a whole set of prayers, for example, that are meditations on the events of Mary's life. This kind of thing. And this begins then a discussion that centers primarily around her conception. Was she also immune from original sin? Mary, of course, did not sin. This was assumed. Holy Mary, Theotokos, but was she also immune from original sin? And if you talk about this, of course, obviously you get to the question of conception. And here, there were a number of issues, a number of answers given to this question. When in 1140, the canons of Lyon introduced a festival honoring the Immaculate Conception, they were reprimanded by St. Bernard of Clairvaux, because this was not proper. Bernard felt that Mary was conceived in sin, in other words, the conception was not immaculate, but that the conception was cleansed prior to the birth of Mary, so that she was, as it were, sanctified in utero, rather than immaculately conceived. St. Thomas still opposes Mary's immaculate conception and agrees with St. Bernard that she was purified in the womb. Similarly, St. Bonaventure, but he allows at least for the possibility that she was immaculately conceived. Then it is especially the Franciscans in the 13th century, and Duns Scotus, the great scholastic philosopher of the 13th century, who give credence and teach as a fact the Immaculate Conception of the Virgin Mary. This, of course, is not made dogma in the Roman Catholic Church until the 19th century. The proclamation of Pius the Ninth in 1854, you'll take that up in Church History 3. So that, in summary, one can say that all through the Middle Ages, with the discussion of the infusion of grace correcting man's will, you have a concurrent growth of emphasis on Marian devotion that really is never formalized. It's just continued discussion and is only formalized in the 19th century. Okay, I had meant to say that yesterday in connection with the theology of the medieval church. Also because it is a subject that is much debated, and I suppose will continue to be debated, especially in ecumenical circles, today. Then, we'd like to proceed then to the question of councils, the conciliar movement, conciliar theory and practice. One book that I would like to recommend to you beyond all others on this question because it combines a very helpful accent on the theoretical aspects of the conciliar movement with the actual historical events, and that is the book by Figgis, F-I-G-G-I-S, Political Thought from Gerson to Grotius, published in 1931 from Cambridge. Figgis, F-I-G-G-I-S, Political Thought from Gerson, G-E-R-S-O-N, to Grotius, G-R-O-T-I-U-S, in the 17th century. He gives a great deal of space and is one of the standard authors on the questions, on questions related to conciliar theory. Now, this whole thing begins at the very beginning of the 14th century, at the end of the pontificate of Boniface the VIII. We won't go into his pontificate, since I assume you can read that on your own. Almost every treatment of medieval history or medieval church history covers this. The basic point that Boniface attempts to accomplish is to carry out some of the reforms that Gregory the VII insisted upon in Germany, that we have already discussed, in France. He attempts to carry out this centralization of ecclesiastical authority in France, in Rome, toward Rome rather than toward the English king. This comes out in two areas primarily. First of all, he maintained that the king of France did not have the right to tax the French clergy. It was only the papacy who could tax the French clergy and could, if they so chose, divvy the money out to the kings, specifically in this case to the king of France. This is spelled out in the book, the bull Clericis Lycos, C-L-E-R-I-C-I-S, that should be on the outline here, C-L-E-R-I-C-I-S, L-A-I-C-O-S, Clericis Lycos, of 1296, in which Boniface denies the right of the French king to tax the French clergy. This is a privilege, a right of only of the Roman bishop. Then, secondly, Boniface also insisted that the French clergy could not be tried in anything other than an ecclesiastical court, the church courts. Both of these things were, of course, a great problem for Philip the Fair. France was in a life and death struggle in these years with England, the 100 years and more of strife, of warfare, intermittent warfare. The French king needed the money, and the French ecclesiastical lands were many, and consequently there was a great deal of wealth here via taxation. And secondly, many of the French clergy were more loyal to the King of France than they were, to the King of England rather, than they were to the King of France. This was all a matter of dynasties anyway. And Philip was attempting to assert his authority by condemning a number of French bishops of treason for siding with the English king. At first, Boniface VIII is forced to give in. He isn't able to, he gives in, then he comes back again, however, and insists on all of these things via this very important bull, Unam Sanctum, in 1302, which you find in Bettinson, along with the bull Clericis Lycos, on pages 159 to 63. Boniface threatens to call a council, an ecclesiastical council, to support him, and also to excommunicate the King of France if he doesn't agree to do these things. He says this in the bull Unam Sanctum, insisting that the papacy, the church, is above all kings and kingdoms. Let me read it to you. Truly, he who denies that the temporal sword is in the power of Peter misunderstands the words of the Lord, put up thy sword into the sheath. Both are therefore in the power of the church, the spiritual and the material. The one sword, then, should be under the other, the temporal authority subject to the spiritual power. If, therefore, the earthly power err, it shall be judged by the spiritual power. But if the supreme power err, it can only be judged by God, not by man. Now, that's a very important point. No one can sit in judgment of the Pope in Rome, and if any Roman bishop even suggests that this is allowable, that makes it quite obvious that he is not really the Pope, that he is not really the successor of Peter. No one can sit in judgment of the Roman bishop. This is the kind of thing that comes out in these two documents that you have on these two pages. Well, in response to this, these claims of Boniface VIII, Philip the Fair asserts his own claims by calling the Estates General in 1302 of the French Estates, and where emphasis is placed on the power of the king in Frankland or in France, as distinct from the power of the Roman bishop. Philip made it appear as if Boniface VIII was actually flouting his authority in France, which could only lead to havoc among the French estates, as most of the nobility recognized, and consequently they were willing to side with Philip on this issue. In any case, Philip, however, still had to face the threat of excommunication and the havoc that this would bring about in France. So he sends his lawyer, a very famous individual now, de Nogaret, N-O-G-A-R-E-T, to discuss the matter with Boniface, and when they find Boniface unable to discuss it, set on excommunicating Philip, on precipitating another quarrel similar to that between Henry IV and Gregory VII, the only thing they can do is capture him, kidnap him. Boniface assumes that they intend to kill him. In effect, he does die as a result of the mishandling that he received during this period. Philip then, as it were, opposes the authority of the king in a given geographical area based on civil law to the authority of Pope, which is based on the tradition of canon law. Now, this is very important because this helps us to understand so many of the things that take place now in this growth of conciliarism. Civil law is something that began to be studied in Western Europe again, was studied again in Western Europe in the 11th century. And you have more and more of these students of civil law, that is, the codes of the laws of Constantine in the East, but especially the Theodosian Code and the Justinian Code. The old Roman law, that is a separate legal system apart from the system of canon law. And Philip bases his claims on this legal tradition via the studies of his lawyers, of whom de Nogaret was one. There's a book that just appeared in the last year called The Lawyers of the Last Capetians. I believe that it is in the library if you are interested in reading about these men. They are rather shadowy figures, but the author here has done very well in making their the outlines of their character and their contribution in this area a little bit more firm. That precipitates the problem about which we are concerned today, that is the conciliar movement, because it is the beginning of what we call the Avignon papacy. If the French king cannot control the bishop or the pope in Italy, he decides he can control him more easily in France. And so the seat of the papacy is moved to Avignon. This takes place upon the death of Boniface VIII in 1303, when a Bertrand de Groot is elected to succeed him, and this Bertrand then chooses to reside as Clement V at Avignon. Avignon is it's in that area that we referred to last week as Languedoc. It's on the Rhone. It's just a little ways north of Arles, if you know where that is on your map. The basic point about Avignon is that it is in a semi-independent area. It's loosely related to the Holy Roman Empire through the King of France, as well, loosely related to the Holy Roman Empire through the King of France, in some instances through various duchies in Italy in other cases. But in any case, it's rather loosely related, so Avignon was sort of a neutral area. It wasn't located in the center of Italy, nor was it located in the domains of the French or, say, of the Bavarian kings, but was rather in this sort of semi-independent area. And therefore, evidently, de Groot felt that it was a good place to establish the papacy in this period, when these three or four great entities, the kings of France and the kings of England on the one hand, and the kings of Germany, or the kinglets in Germany and the kinglets in Italy, were engaged in so much warfare. We normally call this period of the papacy the Babylonian captivity, from the 70 years between 1305 and 1377, the designation that is given to this period by Italian writers, and more especially Petrarch in his poetry. Actually, it wasn't a captivity as much as it was a freeing of the papacy from any direct interference. It is by moving it to Avignon, however, the popes tend to put themselves more under the control of the French king than under the control of the various dukes in Italy or in Germany, modern Germany, and consequently Petrarch referred to it as a captivity. It's the Italian point of view. And I think we should read it with that in mind. The great study on the Avignon papacy is by Mollet, M-O-L-L-A-T, written back in the 20s in French. It has recently been translated into English, and I think it was probably appeared a year or two ago. It's called the Avignon papacy, because Mollet attempts to show that the designation Babylonian captivity is quite unfair, especially for the modern historian, because this means that you're reading one viewpoint, one set of sources, and not another. And he goes on to show then that actually the papacy at Avignon was easily as creditable as the papacy in Italy, And a number of great developments take place there that are very important for the understanding of the Reformation. In any case, while the papacy is at Avignon, a conflict very similar to that which had developed between Boniface and Philip develops between the French popes in Avignon and the leader of the in the German area of what's left of the Holy Roman Empire, Louis of Bavaria. And you have the same kind of difficulty in that the popes at Avignon, John the 22nd is perhaps the most important, who appeals to canon law, whereas Louis of Bavaria is always appealing to civil law. It revolved primarily around the question of whether or not Louis of Bavaria was emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, whatever that entailed, with or without without crowning by the papacy. And Louis, on the basis of civil law, declared that he was emperor, even if the papacy did not allow it, even if they did not permit it. When the popes in Avignon attempt to negate this, suggesting the opposite, of course, Louis threatens to appeal to council. And that brings us to the first important element in what we want to say today. In other words, he will appeal to council above pope. He feels, I don't think he really felt that he would gain anything by this, but at least via the threat suggests that a council could, on this kind of a question at least, sit in judgment of the claims of the popes at Avignon. Louis had a number of very important individuals in his court, William of Ockham, the great nominalist scholastic. We'll be talking about him more in connection with Luther. Marsilio of Padua, the famous Defensor Pacis. Both of these individuals insisted with Louis that council was above pope. And also, of course, they would also insist that on the basis of civil law, that the pope is not above the secular ruler, so to speak, either. So that you would have, I suppose, something like council, prince, and then pope in sequence, in their way of thinking. Very much the way a man like, the way Charlemagne thought of this. The pope is merely the chaplain of the prince who is actually in control. The difference here is that Louis can't appeal to his own authority in supporting what he wants to say, because he hasn't got that kind of political authority. So he appeals to this ecclesiastical entity called a council of all the churches, or at least threatens to gain his will against the popes. In any case, at Rents in 1338, and then the famous Golden Bull of 1356, the German princes agreed that that Louis of Bavaria is emperor even without any recognition or without any crowning by the Roman bishop or by the pope in Avignon. So here again you have the conflict between the two systems of law, canon and civil. And another element is added, and that is an appeal to council. Ultimately, both of these are combined in conciliar theory. The next step, then, is the schism that takes place when political elements in Germany and in Italy refused to go along any longer with this French papacy. What happens, actually, is that Gregory the 11th in 1377 returns to Rome. He returns at the behest of one of the great female mystics of the 14th century, Catherine of Siena. But the College of Cardinals, especially those Frenchmen who had been appointed to this college in the 70 years that the papacy was in Avignon, didn't want to live in Rome because of the civil disturbances that were so common there. They feared for their lives. That's at least what they said. This is the reason why Clement V left Rome in the first place. And if we recall the kind of history, the difficulties that the popes had residing in Rome throughout the Middle Ages, I think that their claims have merit some belief in any case. The point, however, is that you have a split in the College of Cardinals after 1378. The French cardinals insisting that the papacy return to Avignon, the Italian and, well, mainly the Italian cardinals refusing to do this, wanting to remain in Rome. When they elect Urban VI to succeed Gregory the 11th, these names are rather unimportant, the French cardinals claim that they are coerced, were coerced into electing this man, leave and elect another. They claimed without coercion. And then you have two popes in the West. Now you have often had two popes. You've had three popes, four popes in Italy prior to this time, but these schisms were not associated with any great political divisions in Europe. It was usually a rivalry among the various well, that's not altogether true either, because it was a lot more than merely a rivalry among Italian duchies. But it doesn't involve all of Europe, putting all of Europe on sides, one half of Europe recognizing the spiritual authority of the Pope at Avignon, and the other half recognizing the authority of the bishop in Italy. This is then where you get the, so to speak, the second appeal to council. Who is going to decide whether a king is really emperor? If you can find no king to back up the will of the bishop, the pope, the answer of Louis was a council. Now you get another question. If you have a French pope and an Italian pope, who is going to decide who is really the pope? And the answer is a council. And this leads to the famous conciliar period in papal history, in Christian history, actually. Between 1409, when the first of these councils is called to settle this problem of too many popes, and 1449, when the council at Basel finally comes to its end in Florence. The third of these councils, the three are Pisa, Constance, and Basel, the third of these is very similar to the more modern councils, such as the Council at Trent in the 16th century, that met over a long period of time, changed places of meeting quite often, and many years elapsed between the opening date and the closing date, when actually the council itself was not in session, very similar to the kind of thing we've got going on now in Vatican II, but where only committees or congregations were meeting. In any case, a council is called at Pisa in 1409 to elect a man on whom all could agree. This meant, theoretically, that the other two would have to resign. the suggestion came from the University of Paris. The council at Pisa elects John the 23rd, who has never, as you know, been recognized, because he was not elected by the College of Cardinals. As every pope must be elected according to the definitions, you recall, of the 11th and 12th centuries that we discussed in connection with Gregory the VII. But at Pisa, you had a number of other people present, people that had nothing to do with the College of Cardinals. Universities, for example, were represented at Pisa, Italian and French universities. Great professors and theologians, canonists, lawyers, men of all sorts, whom they called in to attempt to settle this question, but who had nothing to do with the College of Cardinals. Well, they elected John the 23rd. Well, this was not a canonical election then, you see, and consequently he has never been recognized. But instead of getting one pope, they got three, you see, because the other two didn't want to resign. So the Council of Pisa doesn't help too much, but it is the first of the three, and for that reason is usually mentioned. They're usually grouped together. The council, however, that really carries conciliar theory, or the idea of the church governed by council, you know, this really isn't said at Pisa forward, is the Council of Constance, which meant from 1414 to 1418. I think this whole business of conciliar theory is an extremely important question. We heard a very interesting lecture over the Christmas holidays by Father George Florovsky, a clergyman of the Eastern Orthodox Church in this country, and quite a patristics scholar, on the question of conciliar theory. And he made the point that when these councils of the 15th century appeal to the conciliar theory of the early church, they are appealing to something that doesn't exist. There is no conciliar theory in the early church. These councils were simply called when there was some difficulty. You have local councils that met like our pastoral conferences met, but there was no theory about there being the final authority or the final court of appeal in the church associated with it. So he says what they did in the 15th century was merely take certain practices that occurred in the early church and built a theory around these practices in the 15th century that is actually not native to the early church at all. Well, this is what happens at Constance. It's very important. Emperor Sigismund, one of the successors of Louis of Bavaria, forces John the 23rd, one of those popes, the one elected at Pisa, to call a council to attempt to now to decide among the three. John the 23rd, being an outstanding politician, felt that he could control this council, and when he found that he couldn't, he offered to resign if he were made a cardinal, if he were given control of all of Italy and southern France, and were given 30,000 golden coins. They deposed him. The Council of Constance. But then they were in an even greater hole, because it was John the 23rd who had called the council. Now you've got a council attempting to meet without any papal authority, you see, and no representative of the papacy present. Since they would only recognize John the 23rd, they weren't willing to recognize the other two, they had a council without pope. And that's something new. And this, you see, all before this period, for example, the council at Ephesus and the council at Chalcedon, and then all of the Lateran councils in the Middle Ages, all of these were called either at the behest or with the cooperation of the Bishop of Rome. You see, And in the Lateran Councils, the Bishop of Rome was chairman. He set up the agenda. Everything was done under with his consent and by his authority. Now you've got a council meeting in the 15th century of which this is not true. And so the question arises, can we even sit as a church council? Are we some kind of a bastard session that has no authority at all? Are we the church without the presence of the Bishop of Rome? According to medieval ecclesiology, as we talked about it yesterday, this, of course, was a very, very important question. And to this, John or Jean Gerson, G-E-R-S-O-N, I have him listed a little bit later in the outline, along with a number of books on this subject. He wrote one of them on the unity of the church. Jean Gerson preached a sermon after John the 23rd was deposed and had left the council, or after he had left and then was deposed, in which he said that a council can represent the church in extraordinary cases of this kind. He says, the essential unity of the church always remains in Christ. And therefore, because it is in Christ that the church finds its essential unity, prelates are able to assemble in council to find a true vicar of Christ. He's saying nothing against the authority of the Roman bishop. This is very important, because it's on this basis that Jean Gerson can consent to the burning of John Huss, who otherwise stood for many of the same things. He says nothing against the Pope. He isn't suggesting that popes are not popes if they err, anything of this kind. He is only saying that in cases of extreme emergency of this kind, where the church is simply in the midst of havoc, where you have three or four different sacramental systems now, you see, depending on how many popes you have, that in cases of this kind, dire necessity, this step can be taken, because ultimately all Christians and the church finds its unity in Jesus Christ. It's very important, I think, for understanding what happens in the Reformation. The unity of the church is found then through council in the one undoubted vicar of Christ. And he quotes Cicero. He said, I never loved Caesar except insofar as he was seen to love the state. Therefore, when he, by becoming a tyrant, had altered his love toward the state, I completely turned away my friendship from him. And Gerson suggests that if these three individuals really love the church, they will all resign and make room for peace through council. Well, Gerson, this was a great speech, and it does bring Constance through the crisis. But once agreeing that they can meet without the Bishop of Rome, without his presence and without his consent, the wave overcomes the council, in which they carry this much further, suggesting that actually the church should be governed by council. That council is above Pope, even one who is rightly elected and universally recognized. In other words, they developed this conciliar theory that we were talking about earlier. At this point, then, of course, many of the earlier conciliarists, men like Jean Gerson and Nicholas Cusanus, many of these individuals, for example, had been in the court of Louis of Bavaria, they were no longer willing to go along with this new mood of it, of suggesting that council is actual, has its authority apart from the authority of the Bishop of Rome, and is the true ruler, the actual ruler of the Christian Church. This appeal to a primitive conciliar theory that really doesn't exist. Constance goes so far as to suggest that councils should meet regularly in the church, whether or not they meet by the call or with the permission of the Roman bishop. This is in the famous declaration of Constance called the Frequens, F-R-E-Q-U-E-N-S. I believe that was on the last page, that councils should frequently be called and they should become the center of the church's government, so that the Bishop of Rome and the College of Cardinals becomes nothing more than the administrator of the decisions of the councils. The councils become sort of the board of control. Now, the next step then is to meet at Basel. Between 1432 and, as I said, 1449 at Florence. This happens when this well, there's quite a bit more here yet that we'll be taking up next Monday, and then we'll go on to discuss the mystics. May I find out if is a Merlin Hartzler here? Thank you, sir. Is Mr. Helmer here? Helmer? Is Mr. Groth here? All right. Is Mr. Hartung here? Is Mr. Hallstrom here? All right. Is Mr. Mann, David Mann? Oh, yeah. I don't know how I missed you. Kenneth Carlson and Mr. Shopland. Mr. Shopland here? Thank you.